WPR's Capital. I'm sorry. It's been one of those mornings. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. On Tuesday, voters decide the next Wisconsin Supreme Court justice. Appeals Court judges Brian Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer are both running to replace retiring Justice Shirley Abrahamson. In our first of two profiles, Sean Johnson has this look at Brian Hagedorn, the candidate favored by conservatives.
For about a decade, it seemed like Wisconsin conservatives couldn't lose Supreme Court races. Their formula was well established. Run candidates who are judges, rally a conservative coalition, and drive home messages that will turn out Republican voters in these officially nonpartisan campaigns. State Appeals Court Judge Brian Hagedorn checks some of those same boxes. He's been a judge for 3 years, and he talks about the law in a familiar way.
You know, I believe my job as a judge is to say what the law is and not what I think the law should be. My job is to uphold the Constitution as written.
Hagedorn's conservative credentials were established before he became a judge. He clerked for former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman, and Republican Governor Scott Walker appointed Hagedorn to be his first chief legal counsel, a job he held for more than 5 years.
I was a lawyer for the office of the governor, representing him in a legal capacity. I didn't do politics, I did law, and I did law at a very high level for a long period of time.
Hagedorn says he was involved in some of the most significant cases in state history. His tenure in the governor's office saw major pillars of Walker's agenda challenged and upheld in court, from Act 10 to voter ID. Hagedorn also helped Walker shape Wisconsin's judicial system. He oversaw all of the governor's judicial picks, including Walker's appointment of now Justice Rebecca Bradley to the Circuit Court and to the Court of Appeals. Justice Bradley says she remembers being impressed when she applied for the job that Hagedorn did not ask how she would rule on specific issues or cases.
He and the governor were most interested in what my methodology would be in how I would decide cases, and that impressed me very much.
But Hagedorn's judicial philosophy has been overshadowed in this race by his personal beliefs. He wrote blog posts in 2005 while a student at Northwestern Law School, where he called Planned Parenthood a wicked organization. He criticized a court decision striking down a Texas anti-sodomy law, suggesting it could open the door to legalized bestiality. His opponent, Appeals Court Judge Lisa Neubauer, has seized on the writings.
The blog writings are extensive. They are not just about whether he likes green grass and nice sunsets. They are on key constitutional issues.
Hagedorn also co-founded a Christian elementary school where the code of conduct prohibits teachers, students, and parents from participating in homosexual activity. He said that attacks on the school are an attack on his Christian faith.
And the policies they have are not aimed at people, they're aimed at conduct, and they're similar to what you'd find in Christian schools, Catholic schools, Lutheran schools, other schools of faith all around the state. And many of the ones that you probably attended, many of the ones that you probably send your children to.
Not everyone sees it that way. Shortly after news of the school and of Hagedorn's blog became public, his conservative coalition began to splinter. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, which has endorsed Bradley and other winning conservatives over the past decade, pulled its endorsement of Hagedorn. Other members of the business lobby, normally a major spender in Supreme Court races, have stayed out of this race. Justice Rebecca Bradley says she can't understand why someone would support her but not support Hagedorn.
If they look at the kinds of decisions that I've written and the kind of decisions that Judge Hagedorn has written, they're going to see that they're going to get the same type of justice.
Hagedorn's beliefs may have hurt his chances with some groups, but he got a financial boost this week. The Republican State Leadership Coalition announced a major ad buy on his behalf, urging conservatives who support President Trump to vote for Hagedorn.
That was WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson talking about Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate Brian Hagedorn. Now, in our second of two stories on the candidate, Sean Johnson has this profile of Neubauer, who has downplayed her ties to the Democratic Party and emphasized her time on the bench.
Almost every candidate tries to stay on message when they run for statewide office. Appeals Court Judge Lisa Neubauer is no exception. At a recent debate with Appeals Court Judge Brian Hagedorn at the Wisconsin State Bar Center in Madison, it wasn't hard to guess which points Neubauer wanted people to remember.
My record shows that I am tough but fair. My record shows that I am fair, impartial and independent. Justice, be fair, impartial, independent. That I will be fair, impartial, and independent.
And that was just during her opening statement. Neubauer repeated some variation of tough, independent, and fair at least a dozen times during that debate. And she drove home other points, too. For more than a decade, she said, she's been a judge. And she has endorsements from the vast majority of judges throughout Wisconsin.
Over 98% of the judges endorsing this race are supporting me. And they are willing to support me publicly. I have put them on my website.
In this officially nonpartisan election, Neubauer's ties to the Democratic Party run deep. Her daughter, Greta Neubauer, is a Democratic state representative. Her husband, Jeff Neubauer, is a former lawmaker who once ran the state Democratic Party. But compared to recent Supreme Court campaigns, what Neubauer is saying is less partisan. She steers clear of many of the buzzwords candidates often use to hint at their political leanings. She won't even say who she considers her most influential Supreme Court justices.
To the extent people want to understand sort of where I come from, what my philosophy is, I ask that they judge me based on my record.
Neubauer is taking this approach while others are firing up the Democratic base for her. Among those campaigning here is a group led by former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder called the National Democratic Redistricting Committee.
Bound and determined, I'm back in Wisconsin, you know. How are you all doing? All right.
During a recent visit to Madison, Holder said he did not worry that his support for Neubauer would undercut her nonpartisan message.
You know, it's not as if Republicans aren't doing the same thing, you know? It's not as if, you know, business groups aren't pouring tons of money into these races, you know? And I'm just dealing with the reality of the situation. And so I'm proud to be here, and I'm proud to support, you know, Lisa.
Neubauer says she'll recuse herself from any cases involving Holder. But her opponent, Judge Brian Hagedorn, says there's a reason groups like Holder's are supporting Neubauer.
They want to take over the Supreme Court because they want to politicize it. They want the court to be part of their political agenda. And they think Judge Neubauer is exactly the person for the job.
Neubauer's backers argue it's not Holder's support that's key in this race. Appeals Court Judge Lisa Stark, who has endorsed Neubauer, says it's more telling that 345 judges have supported Neubauer over Hagedorn, even though they both serve on the same Court of Appeals.
That says a lot. These are the people who either their decisions are reviewed by her on a regular basis or they work with her directly. And they also work with Judge Hagedorn. And they know the two of them. And they have supported Judge Neubauer. So I think that speaks volumes.
Conservatives currently hold a 4-3 majority on the Supreme Court. A Hagedorn victory would expand that margin. A Neubauer win would preserve it and set the stage for a 2020 campaign that could flip the court's ideological balance. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson on Wisconsin Supreme Court candidates Brian Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer. You can read these stories or listen to them at WPR.org or on WisconsinVote.org. Coming up next, we'll continue our look at this state Supreme Court race as we check in with a political scientist to learn more about next week's race. Will you be voting? What questions do you have about the two candidates? Are you concerned about how political Supreme Court races have gotten statewide and nationally? We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues in a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. We're taking a look ahead to next week's only statewide ballot issue, the election of a state Supreme Court justice. By law, these elections are supposed to be nonpartisan, but over the last decade or so, they've been anything but, and this year seems to be no exception. Will you be voting next week? What questions do you have about the candidates for Wisconsin's Supreme Court seat? Is there something you look for when you vote for a justice? What issues or judicial topic influences your vote? Are you concerned about how political Supreme Court seats have gotten statewide and across the country? Let us know what you think and ask your questions at 800-642-1234. Send us an email at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. His areas of expertise include American politics and judicial process. Charlie, good morning, and thanks for joining us on the morning show today.
My pleasure, John.
The judge positions in Wisconsin, technically nonpartisan. However, in this campaign, conservatives are mostly supporting Hagedorn and liberals are mostly supporting Neubauer. How have politics colored this race?
Well, and speaking of politics, I'll just note before I start that several years ago, a colleague of mine and I did some research on behalf of the Bar Association, and Lisa Neubauer was the chair of that committee. So I just wanted to mention that because I did have a brief interaction with her. But politics and courts have always been intertwined. Even when we nominate rather than elect, there's always that sense of politics. It becomes much more complicated when we elect, even if it's a nonpartisan election. And in fact, another colleague of mine on campus and I have run over time a question in a survey that we conduct that asks people how they want to select in the state of Wisconsin. And most people actually would like to switch to partisan elections. And the reason is, kind of what Sean Johnson was mentioning in his piece, people are forever trying to figure out who these people are. And knowing if they're a Republican or a Democrat is a nice quick proxy for them. And if we don't have that proxy, then we're always speculating about whether or not these people are political in a particular way. And the candidates themselves are trying to hide whether or not they're political because they believe that's the position they should be in, nonpartisan and impartial.
I suppose the easiest way to tell who's who is to look at who's paying for TV ads.
That's a very easy way to do it. These sort of third-party actors who interject themselves into this process, it's a beautiful proxy. And that's, I think, why we point to it so much, because the language candidates use is often very obtuse. But when you know somebody like John Holder is throwing $350,000 into the race to try to push it one way or another, that gives you a sense of what's going on. Similarly, for Hagedorn, you've got the Americans for Prosperity, which is a Koch brothers-supported group. And so we can quickly look at this and say, where's the money coming from? And in sorry Tom Cruise fashion, like, show me the money. And once we see who's got the money from where, we get a good sense of who these people probably are politically.
Hagedorn and Neubauer are running to replace Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Shirley Abrahamson, both candidates currently serving as state appeals court judges. What more do we know about their background and experience?
What we know, I think, is that both have political backgrounds. Whether either candidate would like to admit it, they are deeply political. But quite honestly, that's how you make it onto a court in the state of Wisconsin. Often when there are openings when we don't have an election close, if you have ties to a political party and that political party has the governor's seat, that's how you're going to get your initial foray into the judicial world. And so Lisa Neubauer is tied very closely with the Democratic Party. As Sean Johnson noted, many family members have either been elected officials or worked directly with the party arms. And even Neubauer herself was part of the Democratic process or the Democratic Party prior to being put on the bench. And Hagedorn, of course, worked for our former governor, Scott Walker, in a very direct and intimate way. He'll make the claim. And it's plausible, right, that he was serving as a counselor to the governor. But I think most people understand that when you're in that position, while you're doing the bidding of the governor, you're also agreeing with the governor in many ways about what he supports.
Let's take a caller. Nate joins us from Milwaukee. Nate, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I just thought one thing that was interesting is the Milwaukee Bar Association, which in the past has evaluated candidates for judge and said both people who with liberal and conservative connections are qualified to be judge. At this point, looked at both Neubauer and Hagedorn and actually voted Hagedorn as not qualified, but did for Neubauer.
Nate, thanks for the call. Charlie, had you heard about this Milwaukee Bar Association survey?
I had not, but bar associations from the national level on down often inject themselves into the process like this, and they try to do what they would argue is sort of an unbiased evaluation. Since they're attorneys who practice before judges, they feel they're in the best position to evaluate whether or not these judges who are seeking positions or seeking higher positions within the court system are any good at their job. These have been criticized for years. Nixon famously couldn't stand this process. Other Democratic presidents couldn't either. So I would take these with a grain of salt. Well, yeah, they're a barometer. They're not the be-all and end-all of measures of whether or not these people are qualified for their positions.
We're digging into the Wisconsin Supreme Court race with political scientist Charlie Jacobs. Is there something you look for when you vote for a justice? What issues or topics influence your vote? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Charlie, in debates, both candidates declined to comment on current cases, which isn't anything new. Candidates usually decline to comment on things that are before the court. But what does their judicial experience or philosophies tell us about how they might rule in as if they become a Wisconsin Supreme Court justice?
You know, both mouth the same kind of things that we hear both from elected judges and appointed judges all the time, which is they're going to remain impartial and they're not going to let their personal views affect the way that they rule in a particular case. And again, that's I think, the public's expectation, because courts are supposed to be these unbiased bastions of justice. But what we know from the data, both from state and from national courts, is that, yes, personality injects itself and your own personal ideology will be present in what you do. I think Neubauer is taking a more what we call judicial pragmatist approach to how she will rule, which is while she'll look at the text and original meaning, she understands that law and social values have evolved over time. Or Hagedorn, who says he appreciates people like Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia from the United States Supreme Court, he's wedded much more to original meaning. That is, what did the Constitution or what did a statute mean when it was first written? And we're sort of make that idea concrete over time and never change it. So his is a much more conservative view. Hers is a much more flexible and liberal view about how you interpret the Constitution, and we see that in their judicial philosophies.
What's at stake here in this election? Taking a look, you know, ahead even to 2020, but what's at stake here in this particular election for Supreme Court?
Well, for liberals who have been stymied in these many elections, as Sean Johnson has noted in the past few years, they want to just hold on to the minority that they have on the court, a 4-3 split ideologically, with conservatives holding the majority. Because if they go to a 5-2, it makes it that much harder over time to try to claw your way back into a majority to have an effect in the liberal direction on these laws. And since Daniel Kelly, who was recently appointed by the governor to a position on the high court, is both up in the air about whether or not he's going to run for a full 10-year term in office or not, this creates a real opportunity for the Democrats and for liberals to try to secure a majority on the court. So it's a really big deal for partisans who are involved in affecting the outcome of cases on the court.
And are there some high-profile cases on their way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court that you think that these candidates could play a major role in?
Possibly, but one of the difficulties is that you know, they're going to have to recuse themselves from cases that they've been part of at the appellate court, and they're also going to have to recuse themselves from anything that was discussed, at least you would expect them to, during this campaign. So while in the near term they probably won't have an effect, in the long term they'll start to hear more and more cases. So the ones that are headed to the court right now, they may not sit on, and that's very typical for new judges. There are several reasons why they may not. And for Hagedorn, if it's something that's left over from the Walker administration that he was directly involved in, it would be very untoward for him to sit and hear that case. So that's a difficulty for new judges like this.
But we have seen in the recent past judges not recusing themselves from cases that tradition would have indicated that they should. So we don't necessarily know that that's what will happen.
You're exactly right, John. I think that Neubauer has made a case that she'd like to change these kinds of recusal rules at the high court because of what's happened recently. Hagedorn has said he will remain impartial, but I don't think he has dived into that end of the pool like Neubauer has and suggested, look, we've got to change the rules. We've got to make sure that what the court does looks unbiased from start to finish. So, yeah, you're exactly right. Politics plays into that process as well. We see it at the United States Supreme Court and in state courts as well. So it remains to be seen if when one of these is elected to exactly how this will play out.
All right. Well, Charlie Jacobs, thank you so much for coming in this morning and sharing your insights with us on the morning show. Appreciate your time today.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. His areas of expertise include American politics and judicial process. You have a chance to decide who the next Supreme Court justice is if you vote next Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Up next, the news. Then we'll explore society's fascination with true crime. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Books, films, television shows, magazines, podcasts. You'll find stories in the true crime genre across all of these platforms. But what happens when we focus on men who perpetrate violence against women, as is the case in most of these true crime stories? True crime stories mostly focus on white male killers who prey on young, white, conventionally attractive women, even though statistics show that 80% of murder victims are men. We'll hear from the author of The Hot One, a memoir of friendship, sex, and murder, which is about her best friend's killing. Do you think it's problematic when true crime focuses on violence against women and the psychology of male killers? How should we tell these stories? Should we focus on the perspectives of victims, law enforcement, survivors? Or do you think it's important to understand the perspective of the murderers? Are you a fan of true crime, or do you avoid it? Why? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Carolyn Murnick is a senior editor at New York Magazine. Carolyn, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So true crime seems to be having a moment right now. There are so many shows and podcasts about murders and serial killers to choose from. Why is that, do you think?
You know, that's a great question. I think these stories have always been around. We've always sort of been titillated by violence and mystery. But I think what's happening now is the confluence of sort of the rise of streaming television, where there's just so much content everywhere, so many new networks that, you know, every single platform is hungry for more programming. And this is kind of the lowest common denominator type stuff just keep churning out.
I think you kind of alluded to us, but is this obsession really new, or haven't we always been drawn to these kinds of stories?
Yeah, I think we have always been drawn to these stories. I mean, you know, the going back to perhaps Jack the Ripper was, you know, before we had streaming TV, we had tales like that and Son of Sam in the 70s. There's always been these figures that have kind of captured popular consciousness. However, what we're having now is just a kind of total blanketing of these stories from all places. As like you said, we now have podcasts and we now have, you know, Facebook streaming TV and we have premium cable and we have, you know, our network television. So it's everywhere.
I guess I just remember as growing up, if you went to the drugstore or any place where they had magazines, there was a whole section of true crime. I can't remember all the titles, but the one that jumps out is True Detective, and they all had the most lurid covers, and almost all of them featured women in peril. And so now we're this is all just on video. I guess that it's what sells. The majority of these shows feature male perpetrators and their female victims, like Serial Season 1, the Ted Bundy tapes, and Making a Murderer. But in reality, the statistics show a completely different picture of who's getting killed out there. Aren't almost all homicide victims men?
That's true. Overall, in homicide rates, men are much more likely to be the victim of murder. However, women are more likely for their cause of death to be the victim of murder from a domestic partner. So they make up the higher degree of murders by, you know, a husband or a boyfriend. And often it's those stories that are the ones that are highlighted on a lot of these shows.
And why we choose to focus on female victims, specifically white female victims, even though they're in the minority. Why is that?
Right. I mean, you know, I would say that I think that has to do with whose perspective are we seeing these shows from? And it's often white male creators and white male editors and directors and showrunners that are, you know, coming up with the stories that they are attracted to, and also showing us the story through the perspective of the men on the show rather than the women. So often, you know, if it's not inside the mind of the killer, we're often sort of following this, you know, this enterprising male detective, or, you know, the male lawyer that won't give up, and it's the women are almost an afterthought.
We see them in the first few frames to establish that there's a dead body someplace, and then after that we kind of forget about him because the focus is elsewhere. That seems to be the formula. Carolyn Murnick is a senior editor at New York Magazine. You can join our discussion at any time at 800-642-1234. Carolyn, what other problems do you see with true crime and the way this genre chooses to tell these stories?
Well, I think a big one is, like you said, the focus on white, young, attractive female victims, which, you know, there's an opportunity cost to telling those stories. Obviously, their stories are worthy of being told. But when we're focusing on those stories over and over again, we're not getting the chance to hear about other victims of color or from minority or marginalized groups that are just as important and, you know, are suffering the same fate at the same time. But yet media is not paying attention to them. And unfortunately, a lot of the times police are not paying as much attention to them.
Let's take a call. Mark is with us from Bloomer. Mark, good morning. Thanks for being on the morning show today.
Hey, good morning. I don't understand why anybody would want to watch that stuff anyhow. This world is full of beautiful, wonderful, great, and amazing things. And to sit around and watch somebody else's misery and sorrow, and what purpose does it serve? How does that inherently improve our world in any way at all? That's what I want to know.
Mark, thanks for that call. So what is the attraction? Why do we watch this stuff?
Right. Well, you know, what I think is, in its essence, crime is always going to fascinate us because it's connected to so many big themes that are important to all of us, which is, you know, trauma and loss and death and how, you know, can we really ever know another person or are we safe? And these are big concepts that are a part of all of our lives. The problem I see, unfortunately, is that so much crime coverage does not get at these big ideas. It just sort of glosses over the surface and continues to do the same thing over and over again without telling a larger story.
Let's talk about some specific true crime shows. We'll start with the Netflix series Inside the Criminal Mind. The show's opening credits have men stalking through the woods, struggling to overpower their female victims, blood splatters from crime scenes, and then close-ups of dead female victims. Let's hear some of that.
What makes a serial killer? What drives them towards sadistic murder?
There are many, many reasons why a person can end up being evil.
What are the roots of their cold-blooded brutality?
Wow, movie
yeah.
Trailer voice, could it be more lurid? This is pretty typical of the language and imagery of true crime, and how is this problematic?
I mean, absolutely. I think we both felt, you know, that music comes on, it's like, oh, ominous, and, you know, but I think that we all know what to expect. I think why it's problematic is because it sort of numbs us, because we know we've seen it before. It's another story of a dead girl, and, you know, let's spend a few minutes trying to get inside the mind of this of this male killer, and that's really elevating the violence from my perspective, and that's exalting this misogynistic person rather than taking the chance to tell a new story.
We're talking with Carolyn Murnick about the true crime genre and why it's so problematic. She's a senior writer at New York Magazine and author of The Hot One, a memoir of friendship, sex, and murder. We want to know what you think about all of this, and you can join our conversation with Carolyn Murnick at 800-642-1234. Let's take another caller. Mike is joining us from Franklin. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Hey, so I am from Wisconsin, from Franklin, criminal justice major. One of the past callers mentioned just kind of why someone would be interested in dealing with someone else's sorrows. And I definitely have some compassion toward the victim. But just coming from my degree, it's more or less just an interest of what happened and why and what can we do further. A lot of things like the Miranda rights, bad things happen, and then we can correct them. So your Miranda rights, that was a actual rapist that we let go due to unfortunate circumstances, and the law got changed. So sometimes when you uncover certain murders or crimes, you're exposing the truth. However, you're making it available for changes in the law and exposing it to the public.
All right, Mike, thanks for sharing that. What about that? I mean, Mike's interest in this is making sure that we always catch the bad guy. I'm probably oversimplifying that. But is it possible for true crime shows to be done right, as you might see it?
You know, I think so. And in fact, the point that your caller was making is that, you know, there's larger ideas here that are at play when, you know, that are tangled up in crime. And I would like, to me, the most successful shows that deal with crime are ones that get at these bigger ideas. For example, a show that I was very impressed with on Netflix from a couple of years ago was this limited series called The Keepers, which uncovered the rash of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church in Baltimore, and it followed the disappearance and murder of a nun who was a teacher at this Catholic school, and it went through the perspective of her former students who have been spending decades trying to get to the bottom of what happened to Sister Kathy. And the show did an excellent job of using the story of Sister Kathy's murder to explore these bigger issues of the tradition of brushing things under the rug in the Catholic Church and how loss can really live with friends of the victim for their entire lives.
Our conversation with Carolyn Murnick continues. She's a senior writer at New York Magazine and author of The Hot One, a memoir of friendship, sex, and murder. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about true crime and the problems with this particular genre of entertainment with Carolyn Murnick, senior writer at New York Magazine. Do you think it's problematic that true crime focuses on violence against women and the psychology of male killers? How should we tell these stories? What should we focus on? Maybe you're a fan of true crime, or maybe you avoid it. Why not? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Carolyn, let's talk about another show, the Ted Bundy tapes, which is also from Netflix. The show has interviews with Ted Bundy from when he was on death row, and it gives him the chance to tell the story in his own words. What are your thoughts about this show and how it portrays this story of a man who killed at least 30 women?
Right. Well, first I want to say I did not watch the show because immediately the premise of it just completely turned me off. To me, it seemed like okay, we have another pedestal to put a male killer upon. And, you know, years, decades after his murders, we're going to keep bringing this guy up and looking at him as if he should be the point of interest here. And I'm so bored of that. However, you know, that show did, it was very popular, but there was a little bit of pushback around it online, which to me felt somewhat promising. In fact, Netflix, you know, there was so much activity on Twitter with people saying, I never knew Ted Bundy was so hot. Wow. You know, the show, and Netflix felt compelled to tweet, hey, everyone, there are plenty of other guys on our service who are hot, who are not convicted serial murderers. And so it's sort of like, okay, Netflix, like you kind of want to have it both ways. You're distributing this show that's exalting the guy. People are falling for it. And now you're saying, no, no.
Hey, what would have been a better way to tell the Ted Bundy story?
I mean, I think that I'm personally interested in the perspective of his victims. And in fact, you know, there's a woman who was close to him and somehow evaded his violence. And what about an entire documentary about her? Or, you know, another version of him is a very famous true crime book by Anne Rule called The Stranger Beside Me. And that was about, and she went on to be a very celebrated crime writer, but in her early career, she was working at a volunteer suicide hotline alongside Ted Bundy, and she became friends with him and had no idea that he ended up being a serial murderer. And so why that book stands out is because we get her perspective, and, you know, it's not about exalting this guy again and again.
How do shows like this exploit people's empathy?
Well, what I think they do is they miss the opportunity for us to feel empathy for victims, because when we're trafficking in cliches and we're just showing women as kind of figures at the morgue, or, you know, looking sexy in bikinis, or, you know, drawn in cartoon illustrations, we're not given the opportunity to really see them as people. And that, I think, is the biggest tragedy of all.
Carolyn, you have a deeply personal connection to this topic. Your childhood best friend was murdered in 2001 by an alleged serial killer. Looking back at the media coverage of her death, what is most striking to you?
Well, you know, I've been immersed in this space now for the past decade since I've been writing this book. And I would say that a lot of what I'm talking about, my friend Ashley and her story have also sort of fallen prey to, which is that most of the reporting about her case is focused on the man and the killer. And on top of that, she was also going out in LA and was dating celebrities at the time of her death. And many of the stories focus on the male celebrities that she was dating. And it was sort of like her life gets completely lost in the mix, which was why, to me, you know, why I wanted to write the book in the first place was because I wanted to honor the friendship that we had. And I think for a lot of women, childhood friendship and your sort of first best friend shapes you for life. And so that's really what the focus of my book is. And then I also followed the story of, you know, the criminal proceedings for her alleged killer.
Carolyn Murnick is a senior editor at New York Magazine. Carolyn, you've written, you mentioned this memoir and your childhood best friend, her murder. So this is the true crime genre. You're in the middle of it, as you say. You wrote the book and then you completely rewrote it. Tell us about that experience.
Oh, well, you know, when I first learned that my friend was killed, I was in my early 20s, and this was 2001, and I was sort of just starting my career in publishing. And I thought, maybe one day, you know, this could be a thing that I could write about, because it had been a cold case for many years. And I thought, I want to pay attention to this and really learn what happened to her. And then in 2008, I learned that an alleged killer had been arrested, and he's connected to four other victims. And so I thought, wow, like now the story actually begins, and I'm going to dive in, and I'm going to go to court appearances, and I'm going to structure the book around that. And as I started writing and started sort of thinking about the bones of this story, it hit me that, you know, I was really falling into the same traps that I had been absorbing from watching years of Law and Order, which was focusing on the killer and focusing on this kind of formulaic way of telling the story of loss.
And so then you kind of shifted your thinking. And what was the story that you actually ended up telling?
Well, the story that I actually told, it's still ongoing because actually the trial for Ashley's killer is amazingly going to be starting in a few weeks in LA after this defendant has been in jail for 11 years, which is pretty remarkable. And it's 18 years since her death. The trial's finally happening. But the book, as it, you know, the narrative structure right now was about our childhood and about how everyone sort of has a friend who got away in their life, and that girls, I think in particular, are shaping their identities in reference to one another as kids. And Ashley, for me, was that person. And the title, The Hot One, plays off of, you know, the labels that are projected onto girls and women and implicitly puts them in competition with each other. Why is there one hot one or one smart one or one sporty one? And how do those roles influence your sense of self as you grow into adulthood?
Well, we mentioned, we've talked about some Netflix series or certainly others. Can you think of some examples of network television programming that would fit your view of what an ethical true crime show would be like?
Well, I can say that having, you know, spent many, many years now attending court appearances for Ashley's alleged killer and meeting the crime journalists that have been covering that case and working on shows year after year, I've come to respect the people at 48 Hours, and they've been following this case for over a decade. And while I would say, you know, they only have an hour network format and things do sort of tend to follow a somewhat, you know, expected arc, I think that they are serious journalists that care about, you know, not tarnishing victims, and they care about trying to get as much information out there and giving friends of victims and family members an opportunity to speak.
We have about a minute or so left. Carolyn, do you think that we may be seeing a slowdown in true crime content, or is this going to be a genre that just keeps on going?
You know, I don't think there's going to be a slowdown. And, you know, I would like to think, I'm not sure, that doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. What I'm hoping is that this cultural moment that we're in, which is bringing more stories of women's lives from marginalized communities to the surface, I'm hoping that that will start to influence the kind of crime coverage that we're seeing both in the news and in, you know, the entertainment realm.
Given what you've learned in this book, is there another book in your future?
Well, you know, that remains to be seen. To me, the story is still ongoing because I'll be going out to the trial in L.A. In a couple of weeks and doing some writing about that. So we'll see.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Carolyn. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Carolyn Murnick is a senior editor at New York Magazine. She's also the author of The Hot One, a memoir of friendship, sex, and murder, which is about her best friend's killing. Just ahead, we discover the barrier-breaking players and infamous antics from the earliest days of America's favorite pastime, baseball. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.